someone somewhere has to put the pieces together, and I believe that someone are those who are dedicated to the cause of the Mexican American.
All the pigs and cops try to keep all Chicanos down. Like down here in East Valley Station, right over here in East Valley, there's been about 6 Chicanos dead since the beginning of this year, man. You know, we just want to be like everybody else, but the white people, they're running everything, and they try to keep us down all the time, you know.
East Los Angeles is like a port of entry, and there's been all kinds of people that run out of there into what you described as the mainstream.
These are the voices of the barrio, the voices of the silent minority. They have been discriminated against, ignored, politically emasculated, isolated, and ridiculed. There are more of them here in Southern California than any other minority. We have the second largest concentration of them in North America. They have been quiet, patient, and mostly dignified until now. They are the Mexican Americans of Southern California, the silent minority. Because they have been silent so long, many of us have assumed that all was well with them. Denisio Morales is one of those proud people.
We are a proud people. Someone said to me the other day, well, Mexican Americans don't complain to FEBC, therefore they must not be discriminated against. The blacks have all kinds of complaints, the Jewish have all kinds of complaints, and even the Orientals have complaints. But Mexican Americans don't complain. Well, my father used to say, if they don't like me here, then I'm going to move someplace else. I think that the whole makeup that we inherited from our forefathers is something that has to be understood by those who want to help us.
A younger man who is equally proud and determined that things must be changed for his people is this UCLA student.
The Mexican people, the Chicano people, are going to have the same rights, the same opportunities, the same everything that, you know, white people have in the United States. And the way I'm going about it now is just a very non-violent type thing. But I feel that I'm going to do it by any means necessary.
In the next 25 minutes, you will explore the sounds and thoughts of the barrio. Assignment 70 will bring you face to face with the faceless silent minority. The sounds of the silent minority are many. Here are some of them.
Do you think any of our news is being reported? Okay, can you take on the gang fight? Not just the gang fight, the bombings, the police confrontations, the confrontations every week that come down in East LA. You think they're being reported? No, they aren't. Because, you know why? Because there's a suppression in the American news. Because they don't want this news to be printed in the other cities. Okay, well, they can suppress us, but they can't suppress a riot that's going to come down and kill some cops. When some cops start dying, they got to stop suppressing it. They got to get the American people okay to go around and kill people. And that's what they're going to have to do to the Mexican Americans, is kill us to stop us.
Here is another voice from the barrio.
The hostile, rejected, circumvented Mexican-American who feels very strongly that his problem has not been recognized took this opportunity to rebel against the circumstances of his existence. Because people who don't belong to anything, people who are not attached to anyone, people who have never said viva Zapata, or Viva La Raza, or who have no understanding of that concept, people who didn't even know what this moratorium thing was all about, are disturbed, not because of what they saw, but because of what they've experienced in the past.
And still another voice.
The present generation now is going through school and like that, doesn't see things the same way as the older generation does. The older generation is still hung up on the thing about American prestige, the thing about holding up the American image in front of the world and all this and that, and they seem to neglect some of the problems that are happening here in their own country.
The Chicano feels he is the victim of a conspiracy of silence. Washington-based officials talk of millions to help the minority groups. The Chicano knows that minority groups is a code word for blacks.
During the 60s, the decade of the 60s, there seemed to be, at least rhetorically, an emphasis on helping minorities. Now, one would logically assume, at least I assumed when I was in Los Angeles, that this also would include Spanish speaking on some kind of an equity basis. The reality of my personal experience, again, in Los Angeles, was that it did not, except as some kind of an addendum item, or perhaps as an afterthought.
In spite of his silence, the Mexican-American has problems, but he feels it's always been blacks first.
It's always been the exploitation. It's always been substandard education. It's always been the abuse received in the agricultural fields. It's always been the immigrant or the wetback or the illegal being exploited in the garment industry. It's all negative experiences. It's all, and when we ask for attention, we would be told, well, we're too busy helping the blacks. And I love the black movement.
One of the problems arises when a proud people is ground under the heel of prejudice and bigotry.
I've never really been an American, but I've been treated as a foreigner in my own country. That I've never really been accepted the same way as any other Anglo-Saxon. That the color of my skin has made that difference. And I believe that my story can be repeated a million times.
Mexican has been made into a dirty word.
Not only the educational system, but everything, advertising, the whole thing. The whole white society of the United States has done this to them, to thinking that when you say Mexican, that's a bad word.
The Mexican-American is among the last to be hired and the first to be fired. Part of this stems from the poor education given Mexican-American students. Chicano schools have very low reading rates and very high dropout rates.
Largely the education that I'm getting here at UCLA and the education that I've had in the barrios has been irrelevant in the sense that it does not pertain to me. It ignores the Chicano, the Mexican-American.
This Chicano student talks about what white schools do to Mexican children.
Their minds are literally brainwashed into thinking white, and they're rejecting everything that their parents, their foreparents, everything that's natural to them, the whole culture, their language and everything, they're rejecting it so that they can fit into the society. And that's bad because they're trying to perpetrate the concept of the melting pot, which, you know, has never been and never will be, you know, a reality. More a reality would be something called a salad bowl concept, you know, where you have everything in one container, but yet everything is different.
The Mexican-American is frustrated because he feels his story, his culture, his being is not communicated to the Anglo-Saxon world outside. In an attempt to convey the message, a rash of so-called underground papers have sprung into being, yet they don't do the job either. Carlos Conde.
There's one thing wrong with this. An underground newspaper, we might be telling it like it is, but the one thing is that we're telling it to each other. We're talking to each other. We're failing to reach the people that really need to be reached.
Why has this happened to the Mexican-American people? Why does he look upon Anglo-Saxons as an army of occupation in his country? Under the American system of government, one shares in the benefits of the society on the basis of political power. The Mexican-American has little political power.
It's the gerrymandering, the carving up of our area, of our political geography, that is one contributing factor. Whenever we have just penciled the possibility of laying the framework or the foundation on which we're going to build, someone comes and slices it right in half. That's one major contribution. The other one is the fact that we are so concerned with existing. We are so concerned with getting a good job and fighting for better education and fighting a dozen issues that sometimes we don't get down to the basic ingredient, the thing that will make that political muscle grow.
When California was redistricted in 1961, the more than 1 million Mexican-Americans were left without a single political district in which they had a majority. Martin Castillo.
I remember the reapportionment of California. I went up to Sacramento, as a matter of fact, at my own expense, to try to prevail upon the power structure as it then existed, to reapportion it one area where you get one guy elected. And they turned me down flat.
Once again, the Mexican-American was ignored or taken for granted.
This seems strange to me because 90% of our guys are Democrats. And this reapportioning was done by the Democrats. And it just seemed fair, you know. But I asked the powerful man, why don't you do it? He said, well, I'm not inclined to. And I said, well, I asked him why. He said, well, why should I? And I said, well, because you get our votes. And he looked me right in the eye and he said, we're going to get your votes anyhow. So, you know, it's like having a withered left arm. You may have it and you may know it's true, but you don't like people reminding you of it.
Coupled with the political impotence is a native suspicion of authority and a reluctance to form activist organizations. Still, the Mexican-American is learning what he must do.
Our people, as voiceless as they have been, as silent as they have been, as inarticulate as they have been, are no longer going to remain the forgotten community. The time is gone now. You're going to see some sparks fly because our people have learned from organized labor. They have learned from the Jewish community. They have learned from the black community what it takes. The silent, picturesque, fun-loving fiesta, colorful Mexican has not had his day under the sun.
He is learning that the reality of politics is that you must make politicians compete for your vote.
I suddenly realize that politically, you're nothing if your vote's predictable. Unless you want to put a gun to the man's head or something like that, and that's not necessarily acceptable to the majority of Spanish-speaking people. But politically, it's a reality. In my opinion, we need at least a strong two-party system within the Spanish-speaking community. We have to make people, I believe, compete for us, not just take us for granted.
The Chicano has also found out that politicians' promises do not always mean what they sound like, and their false hope breeds bitterness.
I think there was a lot of expectations engendered in the 60s. I firmly believe that false hope is the cruelest hopes of all, that had not a lot of overstatements been made that we felt somehow should apply to us, that this kind of thing would not have developed as rapidly as it did.
Bitterness, in turn, breeds frustration and maybe justifications in men's minds for violence.
I don't think that anybody really wants violence just for violence's sake, but when you don't have no other means available to do it, well, then that's the course you're going to take. And, you know, it's not unusual, though, because the way things have been going, the society, it seems to me, is very reactionary. You have to do something to it so that it can do something for you.
On the street, the frustration wells up into anger.
We're not against anyone, against the black people or the white people. We're against the pigs. We're against oppression. We're being oppressed right now. We're being... Our organization, our peoples, are being created as a stereotype. Every white person that is being raised right now is a stereotype. Is being raised in the white person's mind as a stereotype. Okay, how the hell are we going to grow up and become anything if the white people keep pushing into our minds that we're nothing but a bunch of Frito banditos, okay?
Yeah,
we're a bandito? Well, a bandito's put to jail, okay? Right, in Norco, the narcotics hospital in Corona.
Right.
Okay, there's almost 80% Chicanos.
Right.
You know that? You know why? Because the Chicanos are trying to escape from their environment. They aren't satisfied. They can't dig it. They can't live in this environment.
And that leads to confrontation.
I'll tell you the truth about 1,100 around there. Everybody, the whole man, there was so much the police were scared, man. They ran back twice. They ran back, they didn't know it because they can't shoot nobody. They ain't doing nothing just right there in the park, you know, just like, unless they charge up. And they ran back, and I ain't seen police getting hit in the head with bottles and everything, knocked down on the ground, and they were carried back to the car and ambulance and everything. everything, and boy, man, I wrote, and they just came back the final time, and they just started throwing tear gas at the whole park, man. Everybody ran out of there.
When that happens, there are outsiders who are ready and anxious to exploit the situation and aggravate it further.
I saw people here who I've never seen before, and I live here. I know who walks down the street. I can tell a foreign face. I can tell who comes from Sunset Boulevard and who comes from Watts and who comes from Fairfax. I think there were people here, but I think that just was one more added cream on the puff, you see, that was already there, and it's already blossoming, and it's already rebelling, it's already a thing that was so hot that it had to explode. I think this is only the beginning, and this is a sad note.
Some believe the violence that burst forth on the community may benefit the Mexican-American in the long haul, because it unifies the Chicano against those who exploit him. It also gives him a martyr for the cause.
People who have felt this way before, people who have not had a job, people who have been discriminated or exploited, people who do not understand English, people who have never even taken the elevator in the federal building, people who have been brutally beaten or victims of immigration abuses, have had these feelings, inward feelings, that had no way to come out. Now the message has reached everyone's home. Now the message has reached those who could not even read the Los Angeles Times because they've seen it. And the death of Ruben Salazar has now become a martyr to our cause.
What are some of the things that can be done to give the Mexican-American his place in the sun? Dionisio Morales talks about some things that need to be corrected.
Substandard housing. The thing that made a little noise was the inadequate schooling for our Mexican-Americans. That's going to come out. The matter of unemployment. Major industry, federal government, and especially the county of Los Angeles better start finding ways of employing Mexican-Americans, and rather quick, they better start replacing the equal opportunity sign with something more meaningful than just a lot of talk.
And the Chicano wants to be master of his own destiny in the same way all of us do.
We're not actually talking about you giving us some of the power or us taking away some of the power. I think what it is, it's you giving us the right to make up our own minds what we want to do with our lives. I think it's a matter of self-determination and of, you know, liberation of the minds.
Fundamentally, most Mexican Americans believe in our system of government. They just want it to work for them, too.
All I know is that we need all the help we can get. Categorically, I do not believe in a separatist movement. I believe in us doing our own thing and not relying on other people. But I believe in this system. It's been good to me. It's my country. And we just have to make it work for us.
The Chicano is personally determined that some of the goodies, some of the action of the American way, is going to go to his side of town.
I got involved because I didn't think that the Mexican-American was getting a fair shake. I saw constantly, daily, in both the local government, the county government, and the federal government, that the action wasn't going to our side of town. And I saw a larger group of people with as great a need, and it just didn't seem fair. So the more I saw this, the more I got involved, and the more competitive I got, and the more determined I personally became to change it around.
The plight of the Mexican-American people, proud, bewildered by what the Anglos have done to his land, and silent until now. Too proud to ask for help, and thus ignored by a society that knows only how to react to those who irritate it. Bewildered because his culture and heritage have been degraded by the Anglo-Saxons who occupy what he regards as his land. Bewildered because our schools teach his children to be rude, or put them into mentally retarded classes, only because they don't speak English well. bewildered by a government that treats his people and his problems as if they were the same as those of blacks, when they really are vastly different. Silent in their anger and frustration, because it is not polite to be shouting, demanding, and disruptive. Silent until he has learned that this is not the way of this strange new social order. Eduardo Perez summed the feeling in the heart of this silent minority when he said, "I wish God had made people blind, then a touch of the hand, a word of the mouth, would be all they would need to know their neighbor. People now judge each other by how they look, not by how they are. If God can perform miracles, why can't he make people blind?" A haunting question from the heart of the silent minority. Assignment 70, The Silent Minority, is a production of KNX News Radio. It was written, directed, and produced by George Mayer. Executive producer James Alien. Engineering by Robert Hendricks and Rick Hammond. Technical direction, Cliff Thorsness. Production assistance by Thomas Murdahl. This is Russ Powell on Assignment 70.